Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by the SDR manager of a soap company. Wouldn't you believe it? Caitlin Buckheit, welcome to the show.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for having me.
Lever 2000, or is it just Lever?
It's just Lever, but okay. Who doesn't love Lever 2000, right? So recruiting software, soap, you know, same thing.
So wait, so you don't work for a soap company?
I didn't say that. Just, you know, I was going to clarify before anyone, you know, gets too excited if they're a soap aficionado. The podcast is probably not going to be about that. Managing expectations.
That's fair. That's fair. I do hear you get complaints and compliments about their soap from time to time.
Yes, it has happened. So it's funny, but it is what it is. It's L-E-V-E-R, right? It can happen.
I think that's my favorite new random fact about Lever is that occasionally you get positive and negative, and sometimes very negative feedback about soap.
I mean, they have a passionate following, Lever 2000, so that's awesome for them.
I never thought people could be passionate about hand soap, but here we are.
But here we are, is right.
And I promise we're not going to talk that much more about soap for the rest of the episode. Really, this conversation came about because Caitlin was talking about the SDRs, like the really top performers that she had hired. And then we started talking about hiring and how do you find and qualify for only those top performers. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about sort of how do you make sure that you're sort of cultivating that high performance mindset. So with that, Caitlin, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to dive in with you. Where do you want to start today?
I am super excited to chat about this. I think to start, I have two sort of aha moments when it comes to mindset, especially with managing SDRs. And I think to start, we should go all the way back to my first aha moment about 4 years ago when it came to how do you find top performers? That's really where this story starts.
Okay. Talk to me about where you were at the time and what were you doing?
Yeah, so I was an SDR manager at Eventbrite, and we were about to do a big hiring round. And it was really important we get this right. And the recruiters and the senior leaders sort of tasked me with, we've had a bunch of SDRs. I had been one of them back in the day. We'd been through quite a lot of, you know, 20 plus SDRs in a good way, in the sense of like moving up or just expanding teams over time. And they gave me this challenge to, great, go do an analysis of all of these people that had been on the team and come back with the ideal profile of what makes a top performer so that we, the recruiting team, can go find more. And as you know with, or maybe not know if you're listening, for sales development representatives or SDRs, it's an entry-level sales role, but that doesn't mean you're entry-level in your career. So some of the people on the team were straight out of college. Some had sold before, but weren't necessarily in tech sales and wanted to break into that. Some wanted to restart their careers however many years in. And so the challenge was analyze it and figure out if we need to find these people, how do we source for them, and how do we find out what good looks like? So that was my first ask that came from the recruiting team.
It's no easy challenge to just say, hey, tell me who the best potential candidates are going to be. It's like, oh yeah, yeah. They're all left-handed and their name is Sarah.
Right. And that's sort of what they were looking for. Like this many years out of college, maybe this type of degree, you know, have sold before, haven't, like, you know, do we train their brains? Do we have to untrain their brains? Like, you know, what is it? So, you know, I went back to my desk and it was kind of a loose ask, but a tall ask, right? There wasn't a lot of direction, but I was told I needed to do this. And I just started listing everyone that I had managed or had been on my team and then going through who made that like top performer, the super consistent, always unwaveringly hits quota. And these are super rare on the team, right? Like I'd say usually like one or two, that 100% average. And then there's your other players right under that, you know, definitely are strong performers. They often hit, they don't always. And sort of your, you know, the people that are inconsistent or underperforming. And from there, I went through and identified, why does this person always overperform, or why is this person inconsistent? And I just started mapping it out. And I will say that this exercise, as sort of impromptu and, you know, just trying to figure it out as I go, as it was a super interesting exercise as a manager. And it also helped me figure out and identify gaps of what else does the team need. So I'm going through this and going through this, and I identify at the end the one thing that all the very consistent overperforming top people have. And I'm like, aha, I've got it, right? And it was this positive mindset. And I was so excited. I had goosebumps. And then I was like, oh, shoot, that wasn't really what they were asking for, right? They wanted years of experience and a profile. And how on earth are we going to find, how do you find someone with positive mindset, right? That's where my brain went. It was like, well, now what do I do?
It's so funny because that's like working in the sales development industry, you know, we help build SDR teams on behalf of our customers. And sometimes we do it for people and sometimes we train them. You know, we get this almost the same problem is the customer saying, I only want somebody with this sort of mindset. And I imagine every SDR can relate. They've probably had somebody saying, oh, I don't care what the company looks like. If you can find this mindset, then I'm fine, right? They need to believe this. They need to believe that. They need to be in this situation. It's like, well, there's no list. I can't go to like DiscoverOrg and be like, okay, show me only people with this certain mindset, or show me only the people that, you know, believe in astrology, right? Like it doesn't happen. So with that said, like there's no perfect profile you can give to the team. It feels like it's part of the process of uncovering that. So how did you give them just like a single piece of paper that said mindset and handed it back? And did you get a job after you did that?
No, something, it was a little more scientific than that. So I first had to explain sort of to the recruiters, what did I mean by this mindset? And I think that's really key. And the term like positive mindset or positive attitude, I think gets thrown around so often and no one will debate, I think, that it doesn't help you, right? Like that sounds obvious, but what are we really talking about here? And what it really was is this unwavering, almost in their bones, core belief that they can and will do it. And their brains are so focused on how will I get there and what am I going to do? And it's not if, or there's no doubt. And that, I think I pause here because everyone likes to say they have this, right? And I'm not trying to say you can't, because the second half we're going to get into how do you build this in people, which is the good news. Mm-hmm. But the people that show up with this or with more of an aptitude for it is what we're looking for. And it's this expected belief that they will get there. And I want to be clear that it's not a cockiness. We're not talking about the people that are like, oh yeah, I can hit quota. They often don't talk about it. They often might have a hard time explaining why they're able to hit, but they are so unrattled, and so is their work by a setback, and they are able to continuously look forward with this belief of this will happen, and it keeps them calm, but it also keeps them super strategic and focused. So we talk about that with the recruiters and they're like, oh yeah, this is easy to interview for. And I'm like, phew, okay. Because that wasn't exactly what my assignment had been. So one, make sure you have a great recruiting team. And then two, we had to totally adjust our interview process, which kind of felt very unnatural. So I would say anyone who is shifting, this requires giving up what I think everyone has as their one core or two interview questions they have to ask every time. But you gotta be ready before we get into this to give up your old and be willing to commit to a new way of interviewing that might sound crazy. But as I explain it, I think people will start to understand the why, especially salespeople.
100%. And I'm just gonna throw a plug to a previous episode and I'll do some quick Googling to figure out what episode it was. But if you don't have your own, recruiting team or hiring team, go check out episode 74 we did with Bill Bench. Him and I went back and we shared our, Bill Bench is, I think CRO over at Pendo. Huge, like fat, super quick growing company. He was early at Marketo, helped build out their early sales team. He's got a ton of great stuff on hiring. Our team initially on the predictable revenue side, we started off using the book, which is sort of the follow-on book from the people that wrote Top Grading. And I took a ton of what I learned from Bill and actually modified that process. So now we're sort of doing this modified who process based on what I learned from Bill. So if you don't have a great recruiting team and you are trying to figure out, hey, you know, Caitlin's going to go into some awesome examples of what we're looking for specifically, but if you want to go a little bit wider, episode 74 is where it's at.
Definitely. And I think that's such a great call out because I worked with this recruiting team to learn this. And since then I have come across some recruiting teams that didn't know about this or just not having, sometimes you just don't have a recruiter, right? And so I've helped lead the charge on this, and it's we'll go through it. It's pretty simple, and it's actually more what you as the interviewer do, but without a doubt, these are things that you do not need a full-on recruiting team to do. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's huge. I guess when I move into the process, obviously, or not so obviously, right? I mentioned you're going to change things. What we went from was feeling like you could read their resume and dig into it and ask questions, to sort of putting that out the door. We should trust by the time they're in your office that they should be. This is another huge part of mindset, is making sure you're really present and listening to what the person is talking to you about. So with attribute-based interviewing, we are looking for that positive mindset. It starts with the question you ask. For example, tell me about a time when the odds were stacked against you. Tell me about a failure. And you have to make sure the person gives you a very specific example. For the example of the one of when the odds were stacked against you, you are going to understand when this person was facing some adversity, which in the SDR world, especially and in sales, every day you're going to be told no. How do you handle that? And you're going to dig in and understand and get them to take you back and walk you through the entire process. And the two things that are very different is we move to only asking 3 questions total in a 30-minute interview. I think we leave like 5 at the end for for the candidate to ask questions, of course, 5 to 7. And what you do, and for my salespeople out there, you'll love this, it's listening and discovery. It is asking many deep questions on that one question. So I know that can feel super, not great. So that's why it's important that, or just kind of like you're losing control. So that's why it's important you and your recruiter or whoever's doing the phone screens, even if it's you, are fully aligned. Great. Your resume, you should be here. We've weeded out whatever we're concerned about in a first phone screen. Now we're here and we're going to dig into you, and we're going to understand how you operate and how you think. And we look for different ones. So the positive mindset is just one of the interviews that we do. And that can be one person digs into it. And I've also done it where every person on the panel each has one question, and we all look for something different, in that relates to this element.
That's a really, really good point. And I just want to dive a little bit deeper on the fact that you said people feel like asking or saying less is losing control, mm-hmm. right? Let's take, for example, this podcast. I'm in control of the agenda, but Caitlin's doing all the talking. Right. And it's very similar to how I would run a discovery call or how I would run an interview. Not exactly the same, because, the context is a little bit different. But just because I'm not talking doesn't mean I'm not shaping and steering the conversation. And when we're interviewing or when we're running discovery, we are here to learn about the prospect. We're not here to tell them until we're getting to the point where, hey, we want to try and sell this candidate. But until you want to get there, the candidate should be doing most of the talking anyway. And so you can be in control and not saying anything. And in fact, some of my favorite pieces or some of my favorite parts in an interview is where I can just sit and they finish talking. You just kind of look.
Oh, absolutely. I think if you've ever been a candidate in an interview, there's times where I think everyone has walked out and been like, I didn't feel like I really got to talk about me or what I wanted to say. And it's an interview. It should be about you from the candidate's point of view. Mm-hmm. So again, it might seem unnatural. And I think one of the things is letting go of, like I said, that one question of like, why shouldn't we hire you? Or whatever your one question is. And if you are so tied to that, over time, maybe try and let it go. Like, we don't have to change everything at once. But mm-hmm. when you start asking this question, you have to listen very carefully. So if a time when the odds are stacked against you, if a salesperson is talking about, there is a big difference in saying, they changed the quotas on us or they raised the quotas on us. And obviously it was a new fiscal year, so of course our quotas had increased. How does that person talk about that challenge, right? The first one, they raised it on us, is a little bit of that victim mentality. This was done to me. I had this like lack of control and now I had to deal with it. Versus, kind of naturally, as it was a new fiscal year, things went up. So here I was, with this new challenge. And it's slight nuances, so you really got to be dialed in and you can't be thinking about you or what's my next question, which is why it's also great to have your 3 questions the same every time. Mm-hmm. And from there, and then it's digging in, like, walk me through that. Who helped you with that? Where did you come to that idea? How did you feel about that? What's also interesting is a lot of people won't be able to answer these questions. They might not even have an experience where they can talk about a time where the odds were stacked against them. That's a big red flag and a huge concern that you as the interviewer and hiring manager should be very aware of. That doesn't mean they can accomplish everything. The top people definitely can tell you about this. They have a level of self-awareness and a game plan. And as they talk through these answers, you'll pick up and listen for where was their head at? Making sure you're asking questions, was this their idea or solution, or was it given to them from a manager? And that's where this question will unravel, and you'll be able to see and understand how do they take ownership? How do they view a challenge? How or if do they doubt themselves? And the result, I will say, often doesn't matter. I've had plenty of people who have interviewed and maybe they didn't get there, but it's how do they talk about the process and how do they talk about that challenge? You can even feel the energy, like they can light up about this challenge. That's a huge signal that this person definitely has that mindset.
100%. If you're thinking, this sounds like Caitlin sounds like she's talking about voodoo or black magic, do a little Googling on the STAR method for hiring. Is this loosely based on what you guys are doing?
Absolutely.
Cool. I had a beautiful yet evil mentor of mine in the early days, Joel Greenside. I love him dearly, but he taught me how to interview like an evil, evil human being. Like in the role play where it was like myself, my co-founder, and one of our most senior guys, like two of the three of us, were in tears just in the role play, not like full on bawling, but just like tears in our eyes. Cause it's like, he got so intense and like he taught us the STAR method. Mm-hmm. And he took it to the extreme to show us exactly how deep we needed to go. But like I was one of those guys that had tears in my eyes. It was like, wow, you got so deep so quick. Yeah. And we're talking like in a matter of like a couple of minutes and just the questions he asked, he hardly said anything. And all of a sudden we got to these like deep, deep issues and he's picking up, he was listening so well and then asking really great questions.
Yeah. It takes being totally honest. So I say like, all your sales training and listening and discovery pays off, but it is, and people, I think don't be caught off guard. Like people might need a second because a lot of people aren't used to being interviewed this way. And you will have to course correct the candidate and be like, no, sorry, I need a specific example for this. Like not talking in theory. And it can catch people off guard. And as an interviewer, it takes practice too. And it's definitely not easy, but like to your point, you will be surprised. You will get such a bigger picture of this person and how you think they will show up. And if you're doing that across all the different attributes you're looking for, you walk out of there, like with a firm belief of knowing whether or not this person is right, which isn't, there's nothing worse than feeling in between when you walk out of the interview on a candidate. And the other thing is that, and again, we'll get into this later, but like some people might botch some of the questions, right? So it's in a spectrum of everything else in the interview, but I think these are really huge. And one thing we do, if someone has a tough time, especially with SDRs, if they haven't interviewed a ton, they might not be prepared for this type of interviewing. We tell people, our phone screen has a few specific examples and we'll say, this will be a similar style with asking for specific examples when you come on site. And then also if someone really botches it, but we're really excited about them and it's maybe just the mindset piece, which carries a ton of weight, we'll give them the chance to be like, you couldn't answer this one question. Why don't you think on it? And I'd love for you to shoot me an email by like tomorrow at 9 a.m. like with an answer and an example. And I think just knowing that some of this stuff can be daunting and people can be confused and don't know like, oh, is this failure too big or not to drop in an interview, right? And they're like, oh no, they're gonna poke holes in it, when really we're looking for like a massive challenge and failure and it's okay if they missed.
Because it's not about whether you failed or succeeded, it's about the mindset and it's about how you went through that experience and yeah, what was going through your mind and sort of how you interpreted things. Because you're so right. The lens that we see the world through can have such a huge impact on our performance in the job. I do want to turn it back. I want to have one question. You mentioned this is part of a broad sort of process in your hiring process. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the book? Do you follow like that process or?
No.
No? Okay, cool. I'll send you a copy afterwards. Love the book. Awesome. It sounds like you don't really need it, but it's a quick read. It breaks it down. As a salesperson, it breaks it down like a pipeline, like a sales pipeline. And it's got all these different steps. And I'm like, I'm right at home in the process. So,
okay, awesome.
Mm-hmm. So can you share just a bit of context about just a high level of what your hiring process looks like?
Yes. So we definitely align first and foremost, with the recruiter to make sure they understand or are in lockstep of what you're looking for. I think so often the gap is in you're in this debrief, about the candidate, they've gone through the whole process and people aren't on the same page because if you're the hiring manager, like I'm the SDR manager, the recruiter doesn't live that world, right? They don't know the little things. So I think exposing them before you even start to as much of the process is huge. Like, I've had recruiters just shadow our SDRs process all day and sit at their desks. They interview SDRs after they start. Like, was this what you thought? What were the biggest challenges? I think it's probably like 6 or 8 weeks after they're actually like in the role. What's different? We're constantly asking, what do we need to be telling people who are interviewing? One of our engagement survey questions here at Lever is this like you rate, your expectations of the role versus what was, or your, the role versus the expectations explained to you in the hiring process. And when that's low, we definitely have talked about it. Like, why is this difference different? What do you need to do? So first, making sure the recruiter definitely is aligned and that they feel like, you know, anything that's tough, like if people aren't hitting quota, or if we do change the teams based on inbound because our marketing team is growing, that they are prepared to speak about things, these things as well. And also talk to them about, why do people under and overperform? It just gives them so, they have such a great different perspective than you on talent and finding that talent either through sourcing them or just when they're on their initial phone screen. And we found that that can drive it down. So we have the recruiter do the initial phone screen, which makes sure, why do they want to be here? What is their salary? Are they qualified in the, you know, the basic level? From there, a hiring manager phone screen where we do, you know, that star attribute method on like three of the core ones. So I think one is ability to handle failure, ability to handle change, and a communication one to sort of just knock out any red flags or dig into them when they come on site. After that, they do their on-site where each interviewer looks for something different. We look for a mindset, you know, self-motivated, communication, different, you know, based on where we're at and what we need on the team. And those can adjust over time for sure, what you're looking for, based on your current makeup, if you need something different on your team. And then from there we do, I think it's called career trajectory, but it's a bunch of very specific questions that kind of align all to our values and digs in a little deeper on some of the stuff that we, uncovered in the panel.
Cool. Yeah. I like it. I did want to, before we jump, because I know we want to get to the next section, but I feel like we spent a bunch of time on, tell me about the question and talking about the three questions. Mm-hmm. Spent a bunch of time on, you know, tell me about a time when the odds were stacked against you. You said there are three questions. What were the other two?
Oh, sorry. I was saying three questions in the full interview and yeah. You can do it one of two ways. You can have, okay, I just interview for mindset, or you can have it where each person, like one person looks for ability to communicate and one mindset question, or, and the next person looks for, I don't know, whatever it might be. Maybe it's the role play and a mindset question or whatever else. So it really depends. I think a few ways I've come up with these questions or discovered them, often with the help of a recruiting team or on my own when I've built it, is you literally can Google like, questions, like you were saying, those star method questions, there are tons of forums of them. And so an easy way to just look and Google, you know, looking for positive mindset in an interview, how to ask questions to find that stuff. And you can come up with a whole list. And what I'll say is definitely think through, and you can try them out and you can always adjust them and think through the differences and really listen the first time you do it. A failure and a time when odds are stacked against you are two very different questions. However, sometimes to some candidates, they seem similar, and sometimes it's just nuances in how you do it. I'm trying to think right now if I can think of another one that we use, but there's definitely a big one we use here, especially because we're, you know, fairly early stages and there's lots of, you know, there's natural change in startups and tech companies is tell me about the last time you went through a big change in your current organization. And if they're a student, then you can do it school or in life, you can adapt it. But that's another one that is not the odds are stacked against you, but that is how are you going to handle and show up when things are constantly changing? So there's a whole wide range of how you look for these things. And honestly, I turned to Google. I can't claim I created it all on my own.
That's fair. And so you're looking for adversity, which is like the odds stacked against you. You're looking for change. You said also, I think communication. So
yes, but that's not necessarily tied to the mindset. So I think when you, obviously you can't only in an interview look for positive mindset because you could, you know, someone might not be able to communicate well. And, you know, that's an important strength for a salesperson. So we take a step back and you, when you do that whole, when you did the, when we did the analysis of the whole team and why people were successful, positive mindset was the key one. So we definitely honed in on that. And that was the one that was, you know, my big aha moment of there is something to this. From there, we looked at what other skills do these people have? And then I would also say in companies where I've joined and there's been a team in place, identifying what gaps there are on that team and interviewing for that. So for example, when I first got to Lever, there was a challenge where I think a lot of the reps were, which is very fair. They were hired in big classes and they were, you know, oftentimes if you're more junior, you're used to being at school and being told what to do and doing it. And everyone was doing that, which is great. The challenge was, people weren't able to like kind of think on their feet in the sense of pulling themselves out of this isn't working and how do I solution it? Because as a manager, as you know, sometimes you don't pick up on this until it's too late, but likely your rep sort of has a gut instinct of that. So we started looking, we added that into our interview process and switched something out. When we noticed that people had a tough time handling a lot of the changes that we would go through in our organization, we added in looking for how people handle change and like adjusted the question. So I think whatever attributes you're looking for, you ask the questions for, but it definitely is worth reviewing from every couple of months and understanding where your team is at, if that makes sense.
Totally agree. We do something similar. And it's always evolving. The interview questions we ask, our process stays the same, but really it starts with our scorecard. We do a scorecard ahead of time. And one of the pieces that's on every scorecard for every role is questions, is basically, on like pass fail on like values. And then we'll have questions designed to ask. And we could probably do a better job now that I'm saying this out loud. We could probably do a better job of giving a bunch of different questions, but it's like, tell me about a time when, and like one of our core values here is like the obstacle is the way, which is a stealing from Ryan Halliday from his book called Obstacle is the Way, which is stealing from Marcus Aurelius, the ancient Roman emperor. And I can't remember the exact quote, especially not now on the podcast, but I'll see if I can track it down sometimes when I have my whole brain to think of that quote and not just trying to figure out how I'm going to tie this all into to sort of the next section.
Yeah. And I think actually something you said that I definitely want to hammer home from being a hiring manager for quite some time and learning this process, as well as just, you know, we talk to hiring managers all day here at Lever, is making sure that those questions are the same. First of all, it's a great way to see if you switch everything, if things are working or not, but you're also giving the candidate a different, you know, a disadvantage or an advantage, but making sure those are super solidified, especially for the ones about things like mindset or the ones that are your key drivers you're looking for change. It'll give you such a fantastic baseline of where all your candidates stand and what a good answer looks like.
100%. And I think the thing that I've loved most about our hiring process, because we do some similar things, is I love the way that you've layered in mindset as an important piece. And that's sort of part of every conversation. And so that's going to be on the scorecard at all times. I love seeing the evolution of a candidate over time throughout the process. And the scorecards allow you to do that.
Oh, absolutely.
So one of the things that is really like this thing, this mindset thing. Like one of the things that's challenging when you're interviewing a top performer at another company is how successful were you? Like, are you a great surfer, right? And you were just able to get up on any wave whatsoever, or were you on a wave and it miraculously just took off and became like a super monster wave and you just hung on for dear life? And because that wave was just much, much larger than anybody could take credit for on their own, you happened to just surf the big wave.
Right? Oh, absolutely. And that's why it's so important to, again, people get so tied to 110% attainment on someone's resume. Like that's what I was saying, put that aside. Like you look at that before, you trust they should be there. Make sure your recruiter knows what to look for. That's to your point that if they were just on that wave, that means nothing, right? So you have to figure out how are they going to handle it when that wave is gone. And that's what your job is there as a hiring manager to interview for.
Can you do all the basics like paddle and pop up, or like, did you just get lucky once? Mm-hmm. Because it's impossible to just hire that top 0.1%, right? Just mathematically, you'd be hiring for decades to try and assemble its sales team of 100 people.
Oh, absolutely. It's impossible. That's why you also have to know how to help people learn it and get this, and why some people have it and don't. Because, right, you would miss all your hiring targets and your revenue goals if you only looked for these people.
100%, which I think brings us to your second big aha moment.
Yeah. the second big aha moment was that it's going to sound very simple, like this could be learned, but more how to learn this. So at that point in time, and I'd managed a couple teams since then, it was just how do we interview and hire for this? And like a way to sort of identify maybe what was holding people back. But at that point in time, I didn't know what to do with the people that were always going to be at 90 or 88% average. Not that I didn't know what to do with them, right? But I didn't know how to get them mindset-wise somewhere else, right? It was always focused on process or skills and whatnot. One of my managers had, one of her friends was a career coach, and long story short, she had given us all a free session, and we got to talking about sort of, I knew what I was passionate about. I had kind of moved out of that space, out of the management space, and it was, you know, pretty hesitant to get back into it. So I started working with her, and she kept talking about these, like, you know, limiting beliefs, or how do we, you know, we'll train your brain to, like, you know, we'll retrain it. And I didn't get what that meant, right? This is nothing that they teach you in school. So to my point of interviewing for it earlier, and how I got stuck after that, if we didn't hire those people, I didn't know what else to do. So the second part is how I learned, you know, how the brain actually works and how you can rewire your brain or help someone rewire theirs, to be really positive or to start to develop this mindset so that you can be a successful rep.
And I love that you're talking about rewiring. I mean, there's so many great books on the subject. I think Carol Dweck's Mindset is probably the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And my coach just, you know, shout out to Chris at Empowered Achievers, who first, you know, helped with this big second aha moment. She's a huge fan of that book. And I've also read it too. And it's the stories in that are so powerful. And I think it can almost seem like someone who might be a bit of a doubter listening to this podcast, right? It can seem like, huh, what? Like, it seems a little, it can seem too far-fetched, but it's super powerful. And also it's not a quick switch, right? It takes a lot of time to rewire your brain or to even, and to get the results that can keep giving it.
100% agree. And if you're a doubter, if you're thinking, you know, there's no way that you can change and you can evolve, and, you know, maybe Mindset by Carol Dweck isn't quite your taste, there's a book that's a little bit more story. It's a touch dark. It's a bit of a tearjerker, but it was a real eye opener for me. It was called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor E. Frankl. And my favorite quote from there was, and he was someone who was influenced by Stoicism. If you listen to the pod more than a couple episodes, I tend to bring it up a lot, cause I'm annoying about it. But basically his favorite quote there was, in between stimulus and response, there exists a gap. And in between that, and within that gap is our opportunity to choose how we respond to that stimulus.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the ways that my coach Chris had broken it down, exactly what you said, to a way that was super simple and that is actually how I train my entire team on it, because we definitely train and talk about this stuff, is, right, if you think of like the caveman era, you walk out of your cave, you see a tiger eat your friend. That gap is like that your brain is saying, tigers eat people. You see it again. This is now a second time you're seeing it, right? It is a belief. So then that starts to change your behaviors as well, right? Now you are going to avoid tigers. Maybe you won't come out of your cave, right? And that's the exact same way everything works in your life too, right? The experiences that you go through, they change and frame your mindset, which is technically your beliefs. And that makes sense, right? That what you experience is what you believe, but that can work against you and that can work for you. And so the trick is how do you learn to get that to work for you and get you where you need, but also be aware of, you know, what is it? Because those gaps, like you said, are very quick and they can be really hard to identify.
It also explains why I'm always mildly terrified every time I see a box of Frosted Flakes in the cupboard.
Right. Yeah. No, you're right. Your brain, you associate so many different things that you don't even realize. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I've been in so many jobs. No one ever stopped to talk to me about this because, as I've learned, most people don't even, like I said, they don't teach this in school. Like, you don't know that this is a thing. You don't realize that's why your brain does that. And so, but suddenly it's making different choices about you, right? It's why you might stay a little further away from the tiger pen when you go to the zoo with your kids, right? There, it shows up in so many different ways that once you become aware of it, it's almost, you kind of start laughing at yourself and catching yourself, which is when you can change it.
Yeah. It's not the tiger pen that freaks me out. It's the ostrich exhibits, because those ones are always a bit freer. Like, I've been to a couple of zoos and they, like, you can they can get you, and you have to, I've seen them, like, you see kids up there with their hands on the, and I've, yeah. I filmed it. I'm not proud of myself, but the dad was standing right there and the kid was like, and I'm like, that ostrich is going to bite that kid's hand. And I just watched, and it did. So I keep a wide berth from there. But
there we go. Yeah. Now you have some new beliefs on ostriches, right?
100%. I know that they're jerks and you know, they're bigger than me, so I stay away from them. But it is interesting how these, you know, how this one experience, it gets imprinted on you. And now maybe I'm also afraid of turkeys, or when I run by some Canadian geese, they're kind of the same, but they're on a smaller scale. Right? I keep a wide berth because I don't want, you know, my fingers to get nipped.
Yeah, no, it's very, very valid.
And it's this, it's funny. It's the, like the butterfly effect. It's this tiny little experience. And I mean, seeing your friend getting eaten by a tiger would be a pretty monumental experience.
Right.
The, you know, in my example, the silly ostrich biting the kid's fingers, which I admit I feel bad about, but it was also hilarious. Now that I'm a dad, I'm like, oh, what a jerk. Why didn't he say something? But it was a tiny experience, and it all of a sudden your brain gives it energy, right? It's like, I could have just let that go and never thought about it again. Or, you know, if you keep thinking about it, then all of a sudden it's this thing. And it's not just the ostrich, it's this bird. It's this self-reinforcing belief that I'm terrified of birds. I'm not terrified of birds, but here's the example.
Oh, absolutely. And that exactly translates to if you're a quota hitter or not, right? Like you said, you are giving it birth that you are an inconsistent quota hitter. You are energized and giving it birth that you are a consistent quota hitter, and it keeps happening, right? And that the results in the reality continue to reframe that. So the reason you're also a consistent quota hitter is the same reason you'd consistently be afraid of ostriches, right? Because your brain is seeing and having imprinted that you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And it's the gift that keeps on giving, but the opposite can also happen. And it can get worse and worse and worse, and it keeps becoming true to you. And so, and that's incredibly tough. And your past experiences also can lead up to why you believe this, right? Why someone can step in without any sales experience and be a top performing SDR, right? It's because of how their brains have already had to show up in different experiences.
100%. And it totally works for the positive and the negative. And I'm not just somebody who's like sitting here, I've read some books, like I experienced this. I had two concussions back to back, not immediately, but like 3 months apart. I was cleared to go back and play. I was playing hockey, go figure, because, you know, being Canadian. Mm-hmm. And after the second one, I got like severe anxiety, and like where it was to a point where I was like, the thought process that had been reinforced in my brain was, you know, you've had this concussion, you've damaged your brain. And then you could feel, and it was probably honestly the stress and the anxiety that was doing it to me, but I could feel things in my brain. And I'm like, oh no, your brain's bleeding. Like, oh no. And then from there, it's like, you're going to die. And then it lost, even after all the symptoms went away, the anxiety stuck around, which was, you've had concussions, you're going to die. And I remember like multiple times, like really bad, like trying to fall asleep and just like physically being jolted awake just when I'm on the edge of falling asleep. Cause it's like, here comes this negative thought pattern. Like, oh, don't fall asleep. You won't wake up. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not joking. I'm not making this up for the point. I wish I was making this up for the point of the podcast, but it was just this mental loop. And I talked to a therapist a couple of times. I read a bunch of books on cognitive behavioral therapy. And it was amazing how, when I recognized, so one, recognizing this thought pattern going on in my brain, and then two, being able to reprogram it and say, no, that's not right. And then I basically had this, it sounds funny, but even to myself, but I had this like little thing I would talk back to my brain. I'd be like, no, fuck you. You're wrong. Here are the facts. Get your shit straight. And like, it was a little bit less eloquent than that. but I do curse to myself. If anybody's ever listening that's seen my calendar, I do leave myself mean and hilarious messages, that occasionally SDRs that are trying to book stuff in my calendar misinterpret. It's not, if you're listening, it's not meant for you. Those are reminders to myself, cause I find it funny to sort of shit talk myself. I know it's not negative, it's not serious. But what we're talking about here can have a huge impact on, you know, if you believe that you're not going to hit quota, you're not going to hit quota because you're consistently telling yourself that.
Oh, absolutely. Like I think one of the blockers or limiting beliefs I had to get over was that, in order to be successful, I need to plan. And that had come from lifelong being a lifelong planner, being, you know, a stereotypical first child that was felt like they had to be responsible, being captains of sports teams throughout my life and in college. And because I was always successful, because I took time to plan, and because when I went into a meeting and had planned, of course, you know, I had, you know, brilliant thoughts, and it was this constant need to feel. And then so it turns into, oh my gosh, I need to prepare all the time, right? And that's quickly turns into getting up early, right, to prepare for your whole day. Which is sort of unrealistic, right? You catch yourself thinking, I've been in the SDR space for 4 years. I can definitely walk into a meeting and hold my own. But suddenly it's, you know, it's from so many different things. I even, like, I'm an introvert and read a book about, you know, introverts' brains are better. And it's like, aha, that's why, right? And you start pointing to all these different things. And it can be, and you don't realize you're doing it until you catch yourself in the moment walking into a meeting saying, oh, I'm not prepared. I like shouldn't talk. And you're like, that's weird. Right. And then even in your case, like your brain often goes, your brain in with your concussions was going somewhere so quickly bad and worse about your survival. It wasn't even taking time to acknowledge where you were. And until someone else told you and taught you about this, I mean, who knows what would have happened, right?
And the funny thing is, it was even after I'd seen specialists that are like, oh no, it's super mild. You're fine. Like, yeah. you might have some anxiety. You might have some of this, but like I had a CT scan, CT or CAT scan. I can't remember which one, but they put me in the big machine and they're like, oh yeah, they're fine. And I was like, they're going to find something. I'm going to die. No, it was fine. Yeah. Well, I went and I did all the little tests. They're like, no, you're fine. But it's, and I still, I notice it every now and then it sort of comes back. Like allergies or something. It's like, no, okay, I just need to, this is what's going on. Okay, I just need to remind myself, this is it. It's so funny how susceptible our brains are to little suggestions here or there. And then how that tiny grain of sand can all of a sudden become a reef, become an island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's all of a sudden defining who you are, right? I'm not as good at cold calling as the rest of the team. I'm someone who needs to help, who needs to be the helper on the team. Like all of a sudden you are redefining who you are. And I think what's interesting is what you said, that now you catch yourself, and I do too. Like there's so many things every day I'll come up with like a new belief because, as we said, new things are happening to you. So your brain is being rewired all the time, and you can be intentional in that. But if you're intentionally focused on becoming a consistent quota hitter, there can be other ones that start happening. And once you realize it, and once you've worked through some exercises for it and learn about it, you'll start to catch yourself more. And it's like, it's never ending, and it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. And so I totally agree. And it's funny, this last thing I'll say, and then I want to get back to the frameworks about how we can sort of coach somebody on this, but it's just interesting to notice that there's sort of a difference between sort of the experience and being able to step aside, like, and just sort of witnessing the conversation or the thoughts that are coming out in your brain. I mean, like, that was an interesting thought. I'm just going to let that go. Let's move on to the next one. Yeah. So talk to me about, so let's say you've got a rep who's struggling with one of these sort of limiting beliefs, or they're struggling with something. How do you go about handling that? You just fire them, be like, no, shitty attitude, you're gone.
And then just hire someone that has it. Yeah,
exactly. Earlier. Podcast over. We're done.
Yeah. Great question. And what I will say to all my other managers out there is you will get this wrong. My advice would be try it on yourself first. And you will continue to get it wrong because some people have a hard time identifying their beliefs, and that's okay. What I have found so valuable is even just talking about this framework and talking about how your brain is wired and having living examples of that kind of in your office. But first things first, as a manager, you got to listen for it. No one is going to come to you. I mean, they might, but I have never had someone be like, I'm in my own head about quota, or this is why I'm not successful, right? Because my brain is wired wrong. Like, it doesn't usually show up like that. It shows up in, I remember someone, we were going through their activity metrics, and they were like, you know, I'm just feeling like I should be doubling down on emails because I'm not as good. My cold call conversion rate is, I'm not as good at cold calling as the rest of the team. And it's like, okay, that's a belief, right? You are, because you believe that, you are not going to convert as many cold calls, right? I'm just an inconsistent quota hitter. It's okay that I didn't hit this month. I'm going to do like 120, 120% next month. That's a belief, right? I had somebody once say, you know, I started here and I saw people getting promoted in 9 months. And so I was like, okay, it always takes me longer than everyone else. So I'm targeting like, you know, 14 to 18 months to get promoted. And they said it like, and they were doing their big career plan and they said it without thinking. But that belief is holding them back from ever being promoted. That belief is holding them back in everything. So first, you have to really listen for it. And I also think, you know, talking about it, like everyone on my team can tell you that tiger story. We talk about it in team meetings. We do mindset. So they know and to listen for it, but you have to listen for a lot of it. Some people get this quicker than others. And what I will say is when you identify it, it could change, right? It could be, it might feel like I'm an inconsistent quota hitter. It might be something bigger, like I'm just not sure sales is for me, right? Like, and you don't know that sometimes, like, as we said, some of this is super, like, not, you know, overly, like, some of it's super subconscious. Like, you have to dig in and you have to be willing to, like, take that risk and have a conversation about it, knowing that you might go through this exercise I'll walk you through that is gonna, that it's gonna bomb. It's not gonna stick. The majority of the times, though, it will stick. So, and these conversations are powerful just to get people thinking. So first, identifying it, if that wasn't clear enough. And that's not easy. So didn't mean to be a negative Nancy on that one, but that can be very, very tough. But you can, if you're talking about these things, people might start thinking differently.
Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, from there, it's really identifying where it comes from. So I think if you think of I'm an inconsistent quota hitter, what I would challenge you to think about is that a fact? Your rep is thinking that's a fact, right? They are looking at their past. This is an undisputable thing, right? If you look back, we closed out every month and here was your inconsistent quota attainment. They think this is a fact. This is not a fact. This is a belief. And that's a very different conversation. And understanding where this comes from is, yes, that past in your in being an SDR, for example. But then you have to pause and you have to be really quiet and ask them where else this shows up. And they have to know that this meeting will not end until they get deep. And I think it's really important as a manager to share some of your limiting beliefs or what you've had to overcome and give them those examples. So similar to how I was saying, like, you know, that I had always prepared in life, or I was always, you know, kind of deemed the responsible one. That's where that came from. And a lot of times an inconsistent quota hitter probably was not and a 4.0 student, right? They might've still been a good student, but they sometimes got a B plus and they sometimes got A minuses. Maybe they got C's, right? There's a whole spectrum you don't know about. Likely this has been wired in their brain for a long time. If you also think about other experiences, maybe they had a sibling who was competitive with them. There's a whole bunch of different things that could have been their whole life. And I say, go back. I'm like, think about your childhood, think about high school, think about your past jobs, right? People having, you know, a manager that was tough on you or missing quota at your last job, your brain's already wired before you sit down here at Lever to think that you're not going to be there. And then I also challenge them to think, like, where culturally does this come from? If you think about it, if you think of sports, I'm not the biggest sports person, but, sports and, you know, culture and entertainment tell us that each team only has room for one superstar on each team, right? Tom Brady, Steph Curry, like other people are really good, but there is only room for one. And that's not true, right? But often that is what we have all seen growing up. You hear about the one amazing over the top person that can, you know, not, that can be beyond human. And if you already have that one person on your team, this inconsistent quota hitter might be like, oh, well, we've already got that. There's not room for two. And no one says that to you, right? But all of these things have wired their brain to understand that, like, that's what they keep seeing. And I'm going like this because that's what their brain is seeing. I sort of go like that, like the pounding on the head of those are the images that have been placed into their mind over who knows how many years.
100%. And I think probably to the next piece you're going to talk on, but so super interesting. I just finished reading a book called The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, something along the lines. Mm-hmm. Book, a coach recommended it to me. I liked certain parts of it. Some other parts were just okay. But where they talked about this sort of four questions. And so I feel like I know where you're going next, which is, you know, every belief has its root, and not every belief is negative because we intend to be negative, but because it's served a purpose in the past.
Yes, absolutely. How has this helped you? If you're an inconsistent quota hitter, it's helped you because it allows you to sometimes hit 130% to your number, right? Every new month or quarter, you feel like you have a fresh, clean slate. You still are considered a reliable performer. I mean, depending on how, you know, broad your definition of inconsistent is at the moment, right? But you still are contributing to the team. I'm trying to think what else. You, like, this has definitely helped you. You still were able to, you know, be someone that is respected on the team and get there, right? Like, it hasn't I mean, it has hurt you. I didn't mean to say that, but in their head, it's understanding how has it helped you, understanding why have you consistently over all these years still made sure to tell yourself this story. I mean, aside from the fact that you might not know how your brain is wired. And I will say, you know, we'll go quicker through this just for the sake of the podcast, but I make people give multiple reasons, like challenge them. It's that silent manager. Give me two more ways that this has helped you. It also, they're like, it lets me off the hook, right? I don't feel like, and this is where it gets deep. Like it lets me not feel bad about myself when I miss, right? Like that's deep. And that's the kind of answers you need people to come up with to understand why have I continued to do this? Why have I told myself this story? How, like, why has this continued to be a thing? Because if they don't realize why it is, it's not gonna change. And then the opposite of this, how has this hurt you? And this is where it's super impactful, right? It's prevented me from ever trying to be a top performer. It's prevented me from reaching my potential because I don't want to take that leap and miss. I might not be eligible for promotion as quickly, right? And that this is where the change I feel like in my reps is made. This is where I had someone once be like, oh my gosh, this is where I've had someone cry. Like this is where it breaks down.
Yeah. I can't help but think of the Arnold Schwarzenegger quote, and I'm not going to do his accent. I'm sorry, and I'm not even going to get the quote right. But it's basically, if you're doing a set, it's not the first reps that have any impact. It's the last ones, right? Mm-hmm. If you're trying to do, you know, say you're doing 12 reps, right? The first 11 are just there to get you to the 12th. All of the tearing and all of the actual benefits are coming from that last rep, but you need to do the work of those first 11 to push yourself to the point where you are so tired that it's actually going to tear your muscles a little bit.
Yeah. And just getting that this is hard, right? This can be a hard place to go and this isn't easy, but if you can't just, how does this hurt me? I don't hit quota. That's never going to be deep enough. And if someone's really struggling to get there, I don't always, you know, this might seem tough, but it's, I won't let them go forward. And if we need to, we can end this session and I'll outline the questions and email after and be like, think on these tonight and come back with X number of bullet points tomorrow. Because you have to think about obviously protecting your time as a manager, but some people don't know how to go far that back. Some people don't, you know, in the moment, it might be a little more harder to piece together, especially based on, you know, different experiences, but these definitely come from not just the past week, right?
You're totally right. And not everyone can, cowboy's not the right word, but not everyone can just sort of sit there, think and go, this is it, right? Yeah. Some people need to walk away and think on it, sleep on it, et cetera, et cetera. So there are different types of people. Some are a little bit more, you know, willing to share right off the bat. Some of them want to go and process and think.
Yeah. And it goes back to what I said, where sometimes the belief might be a little off. So if someone's super stuck here, but they've, in other ways, maybe you feel like they're usually more dialed into this, I would just point back to that and be like, do we think it's still this belief like here on the whiteboard? Or do we need to rejigger this a little bit? Which is a totally fair question, because this is, you are not going to get it right. And even I catch myself getting it wrong for me. So it's an evolving process, but it's definitely a healthy conversation.
Right on. And so once you've identified the issue, mm-hmm. Now what happens?
Yeah. So then it's time to talk about making change. And this is, I'll talk about how we do it and then, or how we talk about it in the conversation, and then doing it is a whole nother, you know, can of worms, if you will. So from there, we sort of go to who's someone that can, you know, live the opposite of this. And people get stuck here, especially because it can be hard to understand how someone's brain is wired. So my call out here, and we can talk about this, you know, once we get through the process, is making sure you have kind of a culture of talking about this and people living it, which makes it a lot easier. But if they can't get into that, it's a great time to pause and be like, what's the reality here? Do you feel like you can change this? And sort of like having them realize this aha that I might not know if someone says, like, if someone exactly how they shows up or if they believe something different, if the top quota hitter believes that they can or not, but realizing, do you think that there's something here that you could change? And people and inevitably, usually people are bought into it, because at this point, if you've gotten through the help and the hurt, like they realize it. And from there, it's coming up with, you know, what is your new belief? What are you going to reframe and tell yourself? What's your new daily mantra? So for example, for someone who's an inconsistent quota hitter, it's giving yourself permission, right? It's, I choose to show up and be consistent every day in my calls and emails and trust it will pay off in quota. First, my rep who wasn't as good at, or thought he wasn't as good at cold calling. So you even have to catch yourself on how you talk about this. stuff. His was, every time I pick up the phone, it's a new opportunity to get better, or I'm getting closer and closer. For me, my one about I need to plan in order to be successful. Mine is I plan because I choose to. When I don't, I know I can rise to the occasion. I think done can be enough was another one of mine that I worked through. I felt like, you know, they're constantly had to check things, or it's not good enough, and second guessing yourself. I have someone that was working on feeling like they had to be the helper for everyone. And theirs is something about, you know, I need to serve myself first before helping others. So sort of coming up with that statement. And I will also say that can be really hard in the moment. And this one is totally okay to get someone to think on and come back and guide. But I think the key thing is that you're talking about this new world and have one sort of quick little statement that someone can say to themselves every time they pick up the phone, every time they catch themselves doubting, every time they catch themselves walking into the meeting.
I cycled to our office for about 5 years. I still do every now and then, but I run a little bit. I have less time, and you can burn more calories in a run than you can in the same time period on your bike. But for the longest time, traffic was like one of my biggest causes of unhappiness on my commute home. And I'd get home and I'd be in a bad mood because, you know, you get like cut off by this or cut off by that. And then I would just spend the whole rest of the ride ruminating on, oh, this one idiot and this and that. And I had to do the same thing. And I basically came up with the situation was somebody does something stupid in traffic. And my response was tell myself, nobody cares. And it was simple. Nobody cares. And I repeated that. Now when something happens, I just let it go. Like I sit there, I observe, yes, you did something stupid. Hey, I'm still alive. That's great. There's nothing I can do to impact the situation. Nobody cares. So I'm not going to hang on to it, be angry the entire way home, and then go and infect my wife with these negative emotions because I wasn't, and it's not because somebody had cut me off. It's because I wasn't able to let go of the fact that somebody cut me off, and I had to come home and make somebody else miserable because I was miserable. And I just realized it was such like a selfish cycle that I was stuck in.
No, absolutely. I think even what you
did whatsoever.
And what you said about coming home and bringing it to your wife, like that sort of stuff goes into how does it hurt you too? Like a lot of this negative thinking starts to affect your relationships, your life outside of work. So many different areas, and it makes you maybe just you're an unhappy person. You're more stressed. You just got off of work and you go home and you're more miserable, right? Because of something that you are allowing yourself, to become miserable about. all it takes is that conscious awareness of it. This is easier. It takes it over time, right? Over time of telling your brain that nobody cares, you start to let go. And that's where you're moving into that practice of how do you weave that into your life?
Totally. And I definitely want to get to reinforcement. You bring up a really good point though. It wasn't that I was like forcing myself. So in a way I was forcing myself to let it go. But I think the realization was the fact that in not letting it go, that I was meditating on the idea that somebody cut me off, right? Like I was focusing my attention. I was reliving the event. I was doing that to myself, right? As opposed to like, I grabbed this moment and I was hanging on and I was diverting energy towards hanging on to this crappy thing. Yeah. When I realized like, just like open your hand, let it go. It's actually way more energy to hang on to it than to just like, to let it go and to move on.
Yeah. And it probably took you a long time to even come to that realization, right? And so if you compound that with quota or something that could put your job at risk, you just grasped even tighter and even harder and can fall so much quicker. And it can just get so much more intense, not to downplay your bicycle incident, but when the stakes are much higher, think of how much more drastic that is.
Hey, I could have died, Caitlin. I could have died. I totally see where you're coming from though. I 100% wish I had this, this strong of a mental sort of frame to see the world through back when I carried a bag as a full-time rep.
Yeah.
So with that said, how do we move from, so we've identified the issue, we've chosen our new reality, but if we only do it once, it's not gonna have any real impact. So how do you make sure you live that and you reinforce those beliefs?
Yeah, I think there's the kind of the I see the personal level, and then I can talk about some ways that I've done this to make it a culture and a team kind of norm. So on the I see level, individual contributor, sorry, or if I was going to do it for myself, it's, you know, what is the time? There needs to be a time of day you kind of go through in your head everything where you're really aware of what do I want to change. So for me, when I walk to the train in the morning, there's kind of this big halfway point where there's a big intersection, and I always get stuck. And for whatever reason in my head, at that point, I feel like more like I'm going to work than the time from when I leave my house, because it's like so close to home, right? And that is what I'm waiting there, where I'm like going through in my head, like, what are the things I want to like know, right? So part of that is you can do it when you're brushing your teeth, you can, but something repetitive that you do every day where you stop and you start to associate that with that time of, with that time of day. And then the other thing is making sure that when you are catching yourself doing that, right? So for example, when you, you know, are in that traffic, that you're telling yourself that then, as soon as you hear that doubt in your head, or as soon as you're potentially going to be in that experience or that situation where it's happening, it's catching it. And while that might sound like, okay, easier said than done, I think you'll realize after you go through that experience of going through those, these questions, it's going to kind of like shock you a little bit, and it's going to be easier to become more hyper aware of it. And then as a manager, like we'll put it, we have like a one-on-one like shared Google Doc. We'll type it up at the top. We'll check in on that. We use a tool called 15-5 to kind of get a weekly pulse on the team. And I'll ask like, you know, any limiting beliefs that are in your way this week, or what's something you've overcome. So I think some of that is more, how do you help one person or yourself make this your new normal? Because what if we flash back to how your brain is trained, the other thing you need to do is when you start to see a different result, be hyper aware of it, right? When you start to suddenly be pacing where you want to pace in quota, when you come out of that meeting and I didn't prepare, but I'm like, oh, that was totally fine. Like taking that minute to reinforce and think about it, because that's that moment when your brain is rewired. And that's why making sure people understand how your brain works is a huge part of this, because they have to be talking about it. And what I've also found is people are so excited usually to change this stuff that they're running to my desk to tell me about it without me even needing to check in a one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. And you're totally right. Is you have to be like, this is all internal work that we're doing. This mm-hmm. is, we're going to the brain gym, yeah. Right? Where we got to do those 11 reps so we can get to that 12th one where it's going to hurt and you're going to be walking around sore for a couple of days, but then you're going to rebuild stronger and stronger. So for people, and we didn't talk too much about this in the pre-interview, so if I'm surprising you, sorry. But you know, what are a couple of books that really help, you know, that have helped you and people that you work with sort of get into that mindset?
Yeah. So obviously I know you mentioned mindset. Obviously that's a standard one just based on the title, but one that I've used because I'm a big reader, but not everyone enjoys reading. Not everyone has time for it. People have to have all sorts of things in their free time. I love John Gordon. He is an author that someone in sales enablement told me about back when I was early on in my managing days. And he has a book called Training Camp, What the Best Do Better Than Everyone Else. And what I love about John Gordon's books is, one, they are in this form of a story and people remember stories better. So this one is about a football player who makes it to the big leagues. He has one called The Positive Dog that's about a dog. And they're also short. So some of them you can read in like 40 minutes, maybe others 90, but you can read it in one sitting or within two nights. And it's a story and it's relatable. And he teaches you about things like about mindset or positivity. And he has a whole suite of books on all different situations too on this. But he teaches you about this through a story. And the best part I love is that at the end, there's like the recap, and it's not the recap of the story, but it's like, here are like 9 actionable steps that will, you know, for the training camp one, here are 9 things that the best do better than everyone else. And that's helpful because as a manager, I can point back to those. And I found that people like reading these. So, and some of the examples of things, it's like the best don't measure themselves against someone else, right? That's key for the person who's the inconsistent quota hitter. Mm-hmm. The best are constantly striving to get better, right? So he has this whole list in there. So I think that's one of the big ones. And I know it's on my list. I haven't read it, but some of my reps who are really into a lot of this stuff, because we talk about it and teach it and they latch onto it, have referenced that Grit's another one that they really like as well.
Grit is a great book. Angela Duckworth, I think. Mm-hmm. Like that. Yeah, I'm doing some Googling right now, and Grit Angela. I'm gonna throw all the links in the show notes just so everybody's got the links to the Goodreads pages. Because we also have so on our team, on the Rev team, and so it initially started with just the sort of me and a couple of the sort of senior people on the team. We started a book club. Mm-hmm. Like I read a ton. And so I started recommending books and people were like, hey, we should formalize this. And so as the sort of senior team, we've got a book club, and then it sort of propagated out naturally to all the other teams. And so on our Rev team, Grit and Mindset are some of the first two books that we get new hires.
Yeah. would also add, as we're still on this, Brené Brown's Daring Greatly is another one that talks about, you know, like the power of vulnerability. And it takes being vulnerable to get through a lot of this, right? You have to go back and, you know, recognize your own faults or understand that you're not blaming your parents, but certain things about how you were raised have created these beliefs in your head, and be willing to talk about this and commit to change, which is, you know, always easier said than done.
100%. Cool. All right. With that said, I want to move to the lightning round. Thank you so much for all those. If you're listening, I'm going to have our team throw the links in the show notes. And I did actually...
I was going to say the one other thing we didn't touch on that I thought was really key, and I can go through it quickly. Sorry, not to cut you off and make this my podcast, but
it's your episode. Go ahead.
Creating a culture of it a little bit more. So one was, how do you do it individually? And then two, some of the ways I found to make it where you're just not the manager talking about it is, someone who has definitely embodied this. We actually have them, that worked really hard to come from, you know, like a performance plan to absolutely crushing it as the top, you know, SDR and AE. They actually lead a training in our SDR onboarding about accountability and owning your career. And they just get super vulnerable, which is what made me think of it. And we said Brené Brown, of owning, like, here's where I was, here's where I was blaming, who I was blaming, here's the mentality. Here is every day I read an article on this. And every day before I went home, I pinged my manager, like, these wins, and talking about how they retrained their brain. And then with his permission, obviously I use him as an example when we talk about it. And I have a few other people I do that to. And then also I will say I've built this into performance plans, which I would check with your HR business partner, you know, to make sure you're doing this appropriately. But this is usually where I see someone underperforming really, really get stuck. And we here added it in, or the HR person I worked with taught me how to add it in kind of as a suggestion, where you can't measure this, but here's some advice and some ways that I can help you with this. Here's some articles to read. You know, here's how we're going to reframe some of your wins. It's not just a number. It's not just quota. And getting them to realize, like, in that doc, like, okay, this is important and this is serious. There must be something to this. And usually the ones that embrace that entirely more, almost more than anything else on their plan, come out way on top. So those are just two other tips I wanted to throw in there, because that's where it's not me talking about it, but it's coming from the inside.
Perfect. And I love how you're creating this self-reinforcing culture of everybody's doing this. And I think the best thing in the world has got to be when you're seeing reps that you've coached hold others accountable and sort of being their accountability buddies for that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's more powerful when it comes from, them, like, and a lot of them saw them live it too. Or we even did, after they came out on top, the same rep, this was, you know, a while ago, was like, can I talk for 15 minutes in the team meeting about what I learned and how I did this? And I've learned stuff from it. Like, they come up with all these other creative ways of how they're going to commit to this, and it's awesome. So
cool. That's fantastic. Can I move to lightning round now?
Sure. Go for it. I'm ready.
No, you're totally right. I did miss that last little point on the outline there.
Yeah, I've just found that it's makes it 10 times easier for you as a manager if you do some of those things.
Because then you're not carrying the whole load. You can share and work on the culture and create that culture of supporting everybody.
Absolutely.
Love it. Before we move to the lightning round, I did find the quote, "The obstacle is the way." The Marcus Aurelius quote is, "The impediment to action advances action." Won't go into the details of, like, how the translation and all that, but I promised I'd find it. I did find it.
Love it.
So moving to lightning round, how do you get people to reply to your emails?
I have some pretty, strong opinions on this. So I have two things, pretty simple. One is, make sure every word you are saying is being framed to them, about them, and in the form of, like, their pain or challenge. Like, we go through, take out anything about you. Obviously you can connect that to talking about some of the ways you do that, but it has got to be about them and in the form of a pain. And then the second thing is 3 to 4 sentences. Like, try to keep it short, because especially if you're not doing the first part, people don't keep reading. And I've also found that if you challenge someone to think shorter, they are focused more on what matters, and in a way that is going to catch someone's attention. So those two for sure.
100%. You're not allowed to waste words.
Mm-mm. And even as someone who gets cold emails, like, I read the short ones, the long ones, I don't have time to answer some of the emails that are, you know, about my company and my current role in my team. So the long ones I'm not going to get through, and I'm probably going to get lost in them.
100%. But if you make it quick, easy, actionable about me, yeah. You'll probably get a response.
Yeah.
So how do you handle, let's say you've dialed somebody and they're giving you the brush off. How do you handle that?
I am a big fan of being human and just acknowledging, seems like I caught you at a bad time, and like see where they go with it. I think my advice to, or hopefully the story can resonate with a few SDRs, but early on in my SDR career, I did this and the woman had been like kind of rude to me and just wasn't, you know, it was a pretty aggressive, rude conversation. Like it was one of the bad ones where you're like, oh shoot. And I was just like, I'm so sorry. It seems like I caught you at a bad time. I'll shoot you an email. You know, we'll just end this. The reason why I was reaching out was this, but I will let you go. And I'm not saying you have to always let them go, but this was like pretty extreme. Sent her an email sort of saying the same thing. Like, seems like I caught you at a bad time. The reason was, and she actually, this should be in your inspiration, called me back the next day to apologize for how rude she was and was like, I felt horrible for 24 hours. I was having something else going on in my life that day. I took it out on you. All you were trying to do was help me because I had, you know, framed that value that I just spoke about. And she took, not only did she take the meeting, but the deal actually closed. And so that was a really powerful, again, early on how your brain is wired was
right on.
You overcome these things and it takes being human and it takes patience and it takes making sure you're giving them something that they need. But people have good days and bad days. And I think you really have to remember that.
That's fair. So last one, what do you need to do? What do you do when you need to push at the end of the quarter?
Yeah. My immediate answer goes to remembering when I was a rep, and this is hard because a manager can't make you do this, but we all committed, me and the whole team, me and my SDRs when I was a rep, to coming in all at the same time, despite our time zones. We came in early, we stayed late, and we had like lunch parties at our desk instead. And we whiteboarded every time we got a meeting and like celebrated each other. And I think the power of being in it together, the power of that intensity, that focus, and that energy, and celebrating someone else too, and having that come from the inside is so powerful and can give such fantastic results that it's like hard to even put into words. So there it is.
And was that a mix of East and West Coasters on there?
Yeah, we did everything. So I think that's where it gets tough, is that can be tough, but I think there's ways you could adapt it to at least these hours, or asking if you can, you know, stay later, or just even the act of like all eating lunch together and tallying the wins like physically. And I think there's something to committing to something. So whether or not it's time zone or not, and having that come from within the team can bring results that you didn't think possible at the end of a quarter.
Beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm hesitating to throw an office comment out there, but we'll keep moving. It was Dwight versus the computer, but the cold call segment, time for you to cold call me. So what, tell me about who are you calling? What's my role? What kind of position am I in?
So I want to sell you on working for Lever, specifically our SDR team in Toronto. We opened a new office and we're hiring we have a lot of roles open, but SDR specifically. So I guess I'd be calling potentially just like a sourced candidate in Toronto to that, you know, maybe is a recent grad or I don't know, at a different company to convince them why they definitely need to work for Eric Coe, our manager out there.
Sweet. All right. So you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay. Ring, ring.
Hi, is this Paul? I'm sorry.
Let's try this again.
We both got too excited.
Yeah. I love a call. Ring, ring. Hello.
Hi, is this Colin?
Yeah. How's it going, eh?
Hey, Colin. This is Caitlin. I'm calling from Lever. How are you?
Good. I'm just getting a coffee at the Tim Hortons, eh?
Nice. Well, I came across your profile on LinkedIn and wanted to see if you had a few minutes to chat, as we're hiring. We just launched an office in Toronto and we're hiring quite a bit there. And I thought based on your profile, you looked like a fantastic candidate.
Oh yeah, sure. Thanks for the call.
Yeah. So I'm curious, are you open to even looking at a new opportunity?
I don't know. I'm doing pretty good at my current company.
Yeah. Is there anything that you feel like could be a bit better, or that you dream about or hear that other companies have that yours don't?
Oh, I don't know. It's tough.
It's tough. All right. Well, how about this? I'll give you a high level of kind of what's going on at Lever in Toronto. And then if it makes sense, we can continue the conversation. Does that work?
Sounds good.
Awesome. So I've talked to some of the SDRs there and I'm pretty close with a lot of them and helped hire a lot of them. And, you know, the big difference that they said is that they have versus other companies is they have a lot of access to senior leadership who have all empowered them and almost demanded that they disrupt things and figure out new ways of doing things. So if you want to come into somewhere that like definitely has structure, but definitely has room for you know, changing things up or thinking outside the box, as well as celebrating the losses in an environment where it's like totally safe. That's one of their favorite things. And I've also heard through the manager or about the manager, and I work closely with him, so I might be biased, but I interviewed his team and they talked about how he's the best mix of passionate and collaborative and just has this feeling that you almost kind of can't describe of knowing someone has your back no matter what mistake you make or how you're pacing and is constantly willing to push you and learn. And I thought that, you know, that feeling like someone really has your back really kind of resonated with me, that something so unspoken there. Does any of that resonate with you?
Yeah, sounds good, eh?
Yeah, awesome. So I'd love to, you know, maybe meet for coffee next week and talk a little bit more.
Wow, you're going to fly all the way out to Toronto to sit down and have a Tim's with me?
Yeah, I just happened to be out there. I've been dying to go to Tim Hortons, so, you know.
There we go. Cool. Well, unfortunately, I'm in Vancouver, so I can't meet you for, I'm not going to be up for the Toronto SDR role, unfortunately. But
I have to your sourcing then.
I was really trying to balance like throwing some objections with like, you know, staying in my Canadian Toronto persona. If you're from Toronto and you're highly offended, I'm sorry, I'm a terrible actor when it comes to that. I was just trying to play up all the funny little Canadianisms I know.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna lie. That was, it was hard because you were definitely in character and but like not the character I ever actually come across. So I was not to laugh and I could see your face and I knew you were enjoying it too. But then also I think now I need to give a shout out to all the recruiters everywhere who source because I was like, oh yeah, like we train on like selling and there's similarities in cold calling, you know, a prospect. But in doing this, I was like, man, it is tough to you know, do that cold call for a prospect versus, for someone to be a candidate versus the prospect. So a lot of respect through that exercise.
100%. And just one last thing before you go, if anybody loved the episode and was like, Caitlin, this was great. I want to get in touch with you. I want to work for you. I want to find out more about these books. What's the best way?
LinkedIn, definitely. Shoot me a note. I'm happy to chat more about my experience, things that have and haven't worked, and definitely books. And if anyone else has good books, like I said, I'm a big reader, so send them my way too.
That's awesome. Caitlin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah.
And we'll see you all next week.
Absolutely. Thanks, Colin. Have a good one.
Thanks, everybody.